Thanks for listening to another episode of Project Zion. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. Welcome to another episode of Project Zion Podcast. I'm here, Josh Mingelson, your host, with Bill Russell. Bill currently lives in Lamoni, Iowa. He taught at Graceland for many years, and we are here together recording this at Sunstone, Salt Lake, at the end of July. So the topic we wanted to discuss and bring to you today is a matter of race. Throughout the history of the RLDS Church leading into Community of Christ, the struggles we've had throughout the years to include race, whether that be in priesthood, full inclusion with them. So we just marked many other points of history of how the struggle of RLDS history move from an us versus them mentality to being more inclusive through the years. So I just wanted to start. I don't know if I really necessarily want to touch on the parts of Joseph Smith so much, because that may be more common history to a lot of our listeners. Mm-hmm. But I'll just start into Joseph Smith III, which was his son that joined with the reorganization in 1860. In a conference of 1865, so this is the middle of the Civil War. Oh, no, this wasn't a conference of 1865. It was the Council of the First Presidency, and Quorum of 12 was in a session at the home of Bishop Israel L. Rogers. And then it was authorized for inclusion in the 1878.
Yeah.
For inclusion into the Doctrine and Covenants. But in 1865, Joseph Smith III is thinking about the race issue. And this is in the midst of the Civil War. And one of the verses, it's verse 1C, it says, therefore, this is section 116 that you can look up. It says, therefore, it is expedient in me that you ordain priests unto me of every race who receive the teachings of my law and become heirs according to the promise. 4A says, be not hasty in ordaining men of the Negro race to offices in my church. For verily I say unto you, all are not acceptable unto me as servants. Nevertheless, I will that all may be saved, but every man in his own order. And there are some who are chosen instruments to be ministers to their own race. Be ye content. So I just wanted to speak with that with you, Bill, about the starts of this conversation amidst the Civil War. What did this section mean?
Well, it's meant a lot to the church, RLDS Church at the time. And but in terms of putting it into the context, you know, that 65 is the year the war ended. And as a result, then the Republicans in Congress pushed for some equal rights legislation over the next 3 years. And so I think it's kind of at a high point of the possibility of a white church. There were two problems, you know, two points of contention in that revelation. One was it used the word priests and not priesthood. So a lot of, I suppose, the more conservative saints on this issue said, well, that just means Aaronic priesthood, you know, deacon, teacher, yeah, priest, not elder and so forth, you know. But then, so over time, over the next few decades, that was kind of a controversy. And I think it was, I don't know for sure, but I think it was, oh, 3 decades or so later that we ordained our first elder, Melchizedek priesthood.
That would have been still in the context of the 19th century
when
an elder was ordained.
Yeah, late 19th century. We probably had our first elders ordained. Not very many. We didn't have very many blacks in the church. But we did have two paid missionaries. You know, we had paid missionaries we sent out. And so the other controversy was, well, it suggests that they should primarily do their ministry to their own people. But I think one or both of those two missionaries we sent out was reaching out to white communities too, and probably had some mixed congregations that they spoke to. And anyway, one or both of these men just did not want to limit their missionary efforts with blacks. They wanted to, and in the North, it's probably more integrated kind of societies, I suppose. and although not really bigly, largely integrated. But anyway, that was a controversy. So it took a while for these elders to be allowed, well, before they became elders, and then for them to be allowed to speak to mixed congregations or white congregations. So that was a problem. And the last one ended his work, I believe, in 1928. And it wasn't until about 1978 that Richard Hawks became an appointee, that is, a paid minister in the church. So we had a period of about 50 years there where there were no black appointees, that is, paid full-time ministers. So there, and that's a period of fairly poor race attitudes in the church. In white America. And so it's the beginning of the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s that the church began doing a better job of supporting integration and equality and so forth. And that happened mainly because a lot of people wrote articles for the church publications. And so liberal editors like Roger Yerington and his successor as St. Cyril editor, Paul Willington, they gladly published these articles in the church publications. So I think the membership was educated at a time when W. Wallace Smith, the church president, really had no interest in it. In fact, he was quite conservative, a states' rights advocate, clearly in the Herald, an editorial in 1962. So despite the last two presidents, Israel and W. Wallace, not being interested and not particularly wanting to be conference resolutions, but at the same time, Wilford Windholz, who was really a great pioneer in this area in the late 40s and 50s, he was pushing for general conference resolutions. And in 56, we passed a good resolution, maybe 955. But anyway, that was a movement largely pushed by the membership in the North and not by the president of the church. But then when W. Wallace Smith, the son, came over, he was a much different kind of person, very liberal in his views and so forth. And I think during his period of as president from 78 to 96, there was it already started, but there was just a big movement for a general welcoming of blacks into the church more than in the past. Integrated congregations in places like Battle Creek, Michigan, and Detroit, and a number of other places. And even then, I published some editorials in the Herald in 63 and 65 were the biggest ones, coming right after the Birmingham demonstration and the Selma demonstration. These two very pro-civil rights editorials got a lot of criticism, and the first presidency was very nervous about the pressure they were getting, mainly from some of the Southern saints. And so they wrote an editorial in the August 1st Saints Herald, basically, which was a reply to my, but without mentioning it, reply to my editorial on the Selma March. And I told Morris Draper years later, after he retired from the presidency, because I knew he was a supporter of civil rights, one of the three presidents of the church. And I said, that editorial you guys had in the name of the first presidency in August of 65, maybe it was 63, I'm not sure. It was the one on Birmingham, my editorial. Anyway, I said, Morris, that was really a pretty poor editorial you guys published in August of 1963. And he says, I know it was. And I wasn't surprised. I thought he was the only one of the three that really supported us. And then he said, I wrote it. And I said, what? He said, that was the best I could get by the other two members of the presidency. And he was a junior guy in the presidency. So, W. Wallace, the president, I think, as well as many people for a long time from the rank and file, were supportive. So, but anyway, when the first presidency published that editorial, I think maybe the day he received it or the next day, Walter Johnson of the presiding bishopric, who later soon became the presiding bishopric, he called me at Herald House and he apologized for the first presidency's editorial. I think he just wanted to kind of indicate that you got support at the top, not just because the presidency wrote a very poor editorial. And he said, everywhere we've had blacks in the church, and it's usually been very small numbers, a family or two, we've had trouble. So it hasn't been the presidency acted like it was just an easy integration. He said, it's not been. And he'd been around for a long time. He was an Australian, but he'd been in the U.S. for a long time and rose in church leadership positions fairly fast. I'm sorry he was only he was a bishop, but not like an apostle or a member of the presidency, because he was a terrific guy. So yeah, that was there's always trouble. But I think, you know, since Wallace B. Smith, it's been, you know, we have pretty good marks, I think, since then.
Right. Yeah, it would continue to be a struggle even after Wallace B., but with nothing more than just the human struggle to more fully integrate people of all races.
There'll always be people just more comfortable going to church with people of their own race or nationality or whatever.
Right. So on the LDS side, there's all this doctrinal precedents that would have been integrated in, apart from just the culture that we're living in here, being a North American church, and then moving more abroad. Was there ever like doctrinal or theological underpinnings that would have made it more difficult through this time?
Well, I always think, you know, I often just go back to, I think it's section 4 of the Doctrine and Covenants, which would be in both churches' version of the Doctrine and Covenants. It referred to the worth of all persons. And that's really, in recent years anyway, been an important statement from the Doctrine and Covenants that we use a lot. And certainly that's people that supported racial integration, people that supported women's ordination, and then people recently supporting gay rights. That's always been an important one. And in our new hymnal, now it's only 3 years old. In my observations around, it seems like the favorite new hymn is the one that goes, "For everyone born, a place at the table." And then each verse mentions another group of people who traditionally have been marginalized, but there's a place at the table. Now, it might be just because I'm around more liberal congregations that I hear that a lot, but I've heard people suggest that's our new marching hymn, kind of like "Come, Come, Ye Saints" for the Mormons, you know.
Yeah. So there wouldn't have been any doctrinal reasons, like, so, and this isn't anything that's even, that came out of a vacuum. It was part of American culture explaining that perhaps this race came from the lineage of Ham and they had to be withheld blessings. They didn't, our LDS never had those issues at all.
I never heard that in my life. However, there probably were saints in the South, you know. In fact, I received a lot of letters from Southern saints, unhappy with my last editorial. I wrote 6 of them on race out of the 50 editorials I wrote, and some people think I wrote only on race. But anyway, some people would send me clippings from the Monroe World or the various other ones I'm forgetting now, but Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana and Texas, and they'd send me clippings from the local paper. And some of those you'd get the Curse of Ham and so forth like that. So I suspect there's a good chance that brother that sent me that, the various articles from different guys down there, and they're all guys. I suspect they believed in the Curse of Ham, but I just never heard it articulated in outside of a letter from an irate segregationist or two.
Right. And yeah, and I wouldn't imagine that any of the other doctrinal issues that the LDS came up with would have been an issue other than just the culture of the time.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mentioned D&C 4, but also, you know, biblical stuff. I mean, the 4 Gospels and Jesus, the person who, the Messiah, whatever, who is reaching out to marginalized people who are like the blacks and Latinos and gays and so forth today. So that's why I say our theological base is scriptural, not some theological statement that Israel A. Smith made back in 1912 or something. You know, we wouldn't consider those things theological, particularly, unless they dealt clearly with a theological issue. You know.
Hanging on every word that they speak.
Yeah. See, Mormons, I see a lot of Mormons tend to see everything the prophet of the church, or maybe the general authority of the church, but at least the prophet, says as doctrine. Like I had a friend, a female friend in the MHA, Mormon History Association, who in 1987 or whenever it was that the church came out with here opposing the Equal Rights Amendment. Well, this Mormon female historian friend of mine, I asked her a couple of days later, I said, well, now you've been a supporter of the ERA and now the church leadership's against it. And she said, well, I guess I'll just have to change my position because it's now a matter of doctrine. And I thought, a political issue is doctrine? I mean, some are, I guess, but I don't see that as doctrine. That's just seen as a response to a political issue they wanted to take sides on. But
their own personal
view. We have different views of what is theology.
And how you approach leaders in general. Mm-hmm. So what would have been, for Joseph Smith III, moving back to him and mm-hmm. we'll just move forward, what would his views on race have been personally?
Well, see, I guess he, you know, he's living in central Illinois. He's a supporter of the Union during the war. He liked Lincoln, not Douglas. He was sort of inclined toward Douglas in the Lincoln-Douglas debate of 58. I guess it would be that one. Mm-hmm. And he went out and heard Douglas one time. Douglas has been a friend of the church, you know, so that's probably why he's inclined. Maybe he knew that his dad, you know, had liked Douglas and so on. So anyway, he went to hear Douglas, and he was so disappointed. He thought the guy was drunk, you know, when he was giving his – he might have been. But anyway, so he said, well, to be fair, Lincoln comes in the area before, a little bit later. And so he goes to see Lincoln, and he's really impressed with Lincoln. So that – and, of course, central Illinois, I think they generally – they generally were pro-Lincoln and pro-Republicans. Northern Illinois much more, Southern Illinois much more not, you know. And I think he was a fan of Lincoln, probably a fan of the Reconstruction period after the war. And again, so just like the Republicans in Congress, pushing for equality for the races, civil rights bills, and so forth. And so I think he supported all that. So I think he was a Republican for life. And the Republican Party was really the leader, had more leadership on race, even though it was often timid. But anyway, after the Reconstruction period was over, and over the years, attitudes kind of softened. In 1890s, you had the Ferguson case, civil rights case, where defined separate but equal is acceptable. Plessy versus Ferguson. Sorry, my memory's a little slow here. Plessy versus Ferguson, 1890. And also you had the...
So separate but equal started as late as 1890.
Well, yeah. See, there had been a lot of...
As early as.
There had been integration in our church congregations and integration in a lot of other societies in the North. But Booker T. Washington says in the Atlanta Address, the first time we known in America where a black man spoke to a large, predominantly white audience. And he kind of sold out, in my opinion. He said, well, we're not trying to, you know, marry your daughter, or we're not trying to... take leadership in politics. We don't particularly want, we're not interested in politics. Of course, people are worried about 22 members of Congress already who were African American. And he wanted to kind of tamp down. So we're not trying to marry your daughter. We're not trying to take over the politics. We just want to be productive citizens, you know, farmers and tradesmen and so forth, to help make a better America. And that speech really went over with white America. But critics like W.B. Du Bois, who's one of the great African-American leaders, really blasted Booker T.'s sellout. But anyway, point here that I make, by the 1890s, Joseph Smith himself had kind of softened to where separate but equal apparently is okay for him. And so in the church, where we did have blacks, we tended to create separate but equal. And in Pensacola, Florida, this is the one I know
did
best.
Did they have to, like, sit in the back of the meeting houses, or if they intended, yeah.
Well, I don't think so earlier.
Or were they received?
Yeah. But, like, in Pensacola, Florida, this would be into the early 20th century, they created a separate black congregation. Okay. And it was about a mile from the white congregation called the Pensacola branch. And they were like the F Street Mission, or... I think they had different names at different times. And they were basically just a couple of families and all kind of extended families, always a small congregation. Bill Blue was their pastor toward the 30s, 40s, and 50s. When I went to Herald House in the 1960s as an editor, somebody recommended that I contact Bill Blue, and he wrote a very candid article about what it was like being a black man pastor of a segregated church in the South. It was a Negro pastor who looks at brotherhood. And he was very critical. He stayed active in church, and he moved into prominent positions in the church. And his daughter, Gwendolyn, has been a member of the Standing High Council for quite about 20 years or so. And you know, I'm kind of amazed that they both stayed in the church, given what they went through, having to sit in the back of the room and maybe in a corner, sometimes even roped off. And then the insults they got, like young little Gwendolyn could only go to church camps if their parents went as cooks. They got to be in a servile position, couldn't go. And the young people are going to go swimming one day, and going on, she's about 8 or 9 or something. She puts on her suit, and she's really anxious to go swimming. She goes down to where they load on the bus, and the guy in charge, the youth leader, you know, said, "No, sorry, Glennon, you can't go." Just devastating. Now, there was one appointee minister named John Darling, who's from the north, but he's assigned to Pensacola, so he was a big guy in the church in that area. He and his wife, B, saw what had happened, and the two of them went over and really tried to console her. And for Gwendolyn, that was very important. And so 30 or 40 years later, she's in the Standing Eye Council, and she's assigned to preach one Sunday at the old folks' home in Independence. And she didn't realize John Darling was in the back of the... I remember seeing John there, mm-hmm. and at the old folks' home. My mother was there. And she tells the story of that exclusion and how John and his wife, Bea, had just been so nice to her. Well, afterward, John Darling comes up the front and introduces himself. And so Gwendolyn was really just, you know, surprised and delighted, you know, this guy that she had so appreciated 40 years ago or whatever. So anyway, Pensacola is just a good example of a Southern congregation that was separate from, there were only a few congregations in the South that had blacks in them, but typically then they're pushed into creating their own little segregated congregation. Probably a lot of them just left the church when they were told, you got to get your own. But I don't know that for a fact.
Right. So that's happening in North America mm-hmm. at the same time mm-hmm. at what was happening in other countries.
Yeah, I don't know that much about what's happening in other countries, but the year is around 1900.
How much presence do they even have in other countries yeah. at that point?
Could be. In our church, you mean?
Right.
Oh, I doubt it, but I don't know how early congregations like Battle Creek, Michigan, and
because they're not in Africa until when?
In the mid-1960s, I suppose it would be. You know. And, yeah. So, yeah, but the historians will say from 1900 or so till the end of World War II, it's really a period of very, very bad relations, bad situations for blacks.
It's worse. So under Fred M. Mm-hmm. Smith, mm-hmm. Israel A. Smith, mm-hmm. and W. Wallace Smith, the prevailing attitudes are pretty consistent through that time.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, not necessarily racist. Fred M. got his PhD in social psychology at Clark University, which I believe is in Massachusetts. And so a highly educated man. But I think he just, I don't know of any comments he made. But he was, and this is in Mark Shear's volume 2 or 3, he was, blacks in Battle Creek, Michigan were devastated when he used the word nigger one time. Mm-hmm. He was referring to the driver who brought him over. And he said, well, I had this nigger drive me over, you know. And these blacks in the congregation, what? Yeah. And they've been looking so forward to having the president of the church come to their congregation. But, you know, maybe in the 1930s, it was just kind of common for whites just to refer to them as niggers without realizing what a terrible impact that has on blacks. I attended the Battle Creek congregation for a Wednesday night prayer service in about 1958, and it was an integrated congregation, and the presiding officer of the prayer meeting was black. I'd say it was a one-third black congregation, probably. Maybe that was our most successful congregation at the time, although maybe Detroit, that was integrated. Maybe Detroit, who produced some important Latter-day Saints, some RLDS people who are still, many of whom are still alive and still active. So we've had some successes, you know, but then, I think as Wally B. Smith, 18 years as president, moved on, we just did a whole lot more integrating and more outreach to blacks in America. And then our successful missionary efforts in Africa, and beginning in the middle 60s, and then later on, bringing masses of people into the church in Haiti. And in Haiti, it's interesting, you know, it's French-speaking and all that. That's one of the factors that lead people to say, on a typical Sunday in our church, there's more people speaking French than English. And that's from Haiti and some of the African former colonies and French Polynesia, which is a pretty large church.
Mm-hmm.
And Canada. Well, Quebec, I mean. So... I think that's probably true. But at any rate, I think that you haven't seen any lingering racism in the church that I have anyway, you know, since about the 70s. I think we finally grew up. We've been reasonably okay ever since.
Yeah, so you spoke a little bit about this shift, which would have been a part of the culture of the time in the 1960s, up until Wallace B. Smith's mm-hmm. appointment in 1978.
Mm-hmm.
So just the prevailing attitudes through the 60s is you have a bunch of editorials and you have the general membership that's trying to push the leadership along.
Yeah, the Wilford Windholzes and myself and quite a few others were pushing you know, writing articles for the Herald or Stride, you know, which were pro civil rights. So yeah, that's right. The membership pushed the issue on women. Then the issue that followed that, again, the membership had a lot to do with a lot of writings done, not so much in the Herald, but some. But that was settled by revelation. It was by Wally B. Smith, who clearly favored it, and yet his father had been publicly opposed to ordaining women. And I remember in 1970, his father says that in an article in the Herald, and he said it a number of places when he's meeting around the church with different groups and stuff. So we knew it wasn't going to happen while he was president, unless we just overrode him with a strong Democratic push conference, man. which could have happened. I think maybe would have happened if he'd have stayed in longer. But under Wally B., I think they kind of, every world conference from 1970 on, something to do with women priesthood. But they, and finally, they said in 78, I think it was, no, 76, while W. Wallace was still there. I think his two counselors pushed this, and the presidency encouraged a resolution. I brought in a resolution saying, let's just rescind World Conference resolution from 1905 that said, well, we're not going to have women in the priesthood. Let's just rescind that. We still don't have women in the priesthood, but we won't have that blocking us anymore. Well,
right. So, like, if you have an old resolution that's in direct conflict to a new resolution that you want to bring up, you have to get rid of the old.
Yeah, or else I just declare it out of order, because that's what they did. Declare it out of order because in conflict
with this one. Yeah.
Given W. Wall Smith's opposition, I'm pretty sure Draper and Cooey, his counselors, pushed that because they were both strong, very strong ordaining women. And so finally in 84, I interviewed Wally B. in 2002, and he said, first of all, he said, you know, the editorial in the Herald in February of 84 on disjunctive revelation said, you know, revelations almost by nature, especially if we believe in new light and truth and stuff, it's almost by nature going to be disjunctive. I mean, have some differences from past, maybe some conflicts or whatever from past revelations. And most people thought Wallace wrote that editorial. Actually, his counselor, Alan Tyree, wrote it, but it's under the name of the First Presidency. So fundamentalists in the church say, yep, they're going to ordain women at this next conference, which they did. But Wallace told me, first of all, that was written by Alan. And at that point, I had no plans on having a revelation. But I always spend about a week secluded down at some place in southern Missouri to prepare my conference, you know, gather my thoughts and everything, prepare my conference sermon, which is kind of like a papal cyclical or something in terms of it's very important speech to the church. Sometime during that retreat, it occurred to me that I felt like there was some divine leaning toward of me writing a revelation. So that's how section
156
came forward. But on the other hand, I think we were going to ordain women. It was just a matter of how and when. You know, it could be done by revelation. You know, when these Mormons say, well, we sure hope there's a revelation on women. Well, it shouldn't be made by just one person, you know, and there should be some input. But at any rate, I think that, that worked pretty well. Finally, in 84, as Wallace told me, he wrote his revelation and brought it to the conference. But my criticism of that would be they should have done more to prepare. They should have had more articles in the Herald, like the editorial on disjunctive revelation. There was one on by Neff, Chuck Neff, in 1981 or so, and there were some others. But, you know, they learned their lesson on that. And so then when the gay issue came up, we had a whole new generation in the hierarchy of the apostles and the presidency and the bishopric by the time the gay issue was so important. And so CVC and all these other guys that were not in the hierarchy in 1984 were now leading the church. And so I think they just did a masterful job politically of preparing for gay ordination and marriage. And what they did was, finally they decided, well, let's just have national conferences because there's some issues that are so culturally different and maybe not are just absolute issues to be a worldwide. So let's have national conferences, places where there is clearly strong sentiment toward ordaining and marriage. And so they had the USA National Conference, Australia, Canada, and the UK, the UK, which I think involved Great Britain, and then that conference. And all of them reported out solid majority, like 75% or so in favor of both issues. But anyway, they kept pushing back the time people would come in with resolutions pro and con on gay marriage at world conferences, you know, beginning about 2000 or so. And they would push them back. Let's take a little more time.
I had heard that they had opened up ordination to gay members in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. And then they went back on it. They well, shut it down and then silenced their priesthood.
That's true in a sense that there were a lot of congregations that ordained openly gay men and women. But largely they went under the radar. Like, for example, a friend of mine who was in the Lundgren cult, although he fled it before he usually wasn't reported to authorities, he was in Buffalo, and he was ordained, reordained, because he'd been reordained a long time ago, but then silenced or whatever. And then now he's active in the Buffalo congregation again years later, doing really well, a terrific guy. And so they ordained him again. I think a little higher office, I suppose, but he was just a deacon before. But anyway, they ordained him. And I asked his stake president, a regional administrator, or maybe just a pastor, how did you get Kevin through? She said, we just flew under the radar on that. We didn't say anything. Because my thought was, if they ever silence Kevin, I will be so mad. I guess he's been through hell as a member of the Lundgren cult. You know. So these people, I think, were largely ordained without the top dogs
knowing it.
But there was at least one case, because Grant said in his World Conference sermon of 2002, that he gave a very positive, in the middle of his presidential address, he gave spent about 10 minutes and gave a very positive view of gay rights and the church and so forth. And he says, you know, I've been at services where a gay person, so a person who I knew was gay and in a relationship was ordained, and I certainly didn't, and I didn't do anything to stop it. I mean, it was all right with me. And that was what really caused a big outcry from the South, mainly in the U.S., and then also other parts of the world. So then they kind of backed up, and they said, well, in an editorial, they said, well, we're going to go back to our 1982 resolution, which says, you know, you can be in the church and all that, but you can't be in the priesthood. That is, you're open to gay. You can be not practicing gay and be in the priesthood, but if you ever get into a relationship, then you got to give that up. But we're not going to rescind any of those ordinations that happened, but no more for now. And so that's after the 2000, that's about 2002. But anyway, so then they start carefully preparing, the presidency and the leadership start carefully preparing to build the climate. We had listening circles recommended in congregations where we sit around and give your opinion, but nobody's supposed to criticize your opinion. You just give your thought.
A few books came out to prepare people.
Yeah, one of them was mine, the Homosexual Saints, the Community of Christ Experience. I wrote a 59-page introduction, how the church has handled it through the years, and then I had 26 stories. And I included all the church, there's four church resolutions I included, which show the advancement along the way from 1962 on. And so, and then we had a follow-up book on that and others, I guess, yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot of preparation. And finally, leadership decided that let's go with these national conferences. We never had them before, just world conferences. Let's go to a national conference. And where there's acceptance, let's see if they're ready for it. You know, when there's a huge cultural, I think the Roman Catholic Church has often done a good job of recognizing the world church. There's huge cultural divides. Just kind of, you know, figure out how to not cause a big fight.
Regionally. Mm-hmm. And in a way, I think that it's better. I mean, there's the possibility that if things change too much within any single nation, that then how do we recognize ourselves as a global church, as brothers and sisters when we meet together globally? Yeah. Yeah. But on the same hand, sometimes waiting for everybody else in every other nation to come along on an issue.
Yeah.
Even though the social injustice is happening within the slower countries that are not even, that's not even on their radar of consciousness, not allowing somebody in another country, whether that's in Europe, the United States, Canada, etc., to do that just because we're holding out and waiting for everybody else is a social injustice in of itself.
Yeah.
When these countries are very well ready and it's on their consciousness.
And, you know, some of those nations, they're so conservative, I mean, so homophobic, that if we had passed a World Conference resolution, there's a good chance the church would just dried up in some of those countries, like Haiti and some of the African countries and so forth. Right. So, yeah, it's a very sensitive thing, and I think the VC administration handled it so much better than the Wallace P. Smith on women.
Right. Yeah, so lessons learned. Lost a lot of members along the way.
And maybe a difference is, too, that Wallace B. Smith had never been an appointee. He'd just been an eye doctor in Independence. he like served locally, assistant pastor of a congregation, and they put him on the State High Council, but that's just 12 high priests living in the Independence area at that time. And they only responded to in the presidency asking for their opinion on some tough issue, some moral issue, like homosexuality. Two of those are their resolutions. So, on the other hand, Steve Vesey was about, you know, I'd say the best qualified by far of any president we've ever had, because the others all came out of the Smith family and were basically independence oriented. Or Grant McMurray had just worked his way up through the church hierarchy as just an assistant church historian and then a right. secretary of the presidency. And so, yeah. So Grant had some good background, but Steve had been 70 in Florida. I mean, sorry, yeah, well, so the South, but also Africa. He'd been a minister in Seattle area. He'd been a minister, I think, in the Northeast. And so he'd really moved up through the ranks, you know, and born in Paris, Tennessee, where Wilford Woodruff did his mission, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, so he had really had a diversity of experience in a diversity of cultures, you know, including the American South, which maybe is as important as his African background. So he's been a progressive president, like Grant, but he has a much better understanding of what the whole political, the worldwide political situation for the church. And so that's why the National Conference were very wise, were a way to go.
No, I agree. So moving back to the topic of race, so there's never a direct revelation after Joseph Smith III that brings up race again. Is that correct?
I don't think so. I'm not aware
of it. So it's just all cultural, and just the fact that we have, like you said, this section and 4 that says, "For behold, the worth of souls is great in the sight of God," and that is what springs forth our enduring principle.
Well, but I would say
the worth of all people.
But I would say other scriptures are important too, and so I would say the authoritative statements, especially in scripture, were keys in moving on race.
Right.
I mean, you know, the fact that there's nothing in the Doctrine and Covenants since 1865. I think that's fact. If there are, they're probably kind of subtle, at least in the Wallace Smith years. So even though there are some authoritative statements, and these people that wrote articles in the Herald and stuff, you know, can quote scriptures and so forth. And, you know, there's a lot of them to quote. So I'd say it's authority of scriptures, plus the people are ready. Now, a good sign of that was, you know, all of a sudden it occurred to me some years ago, we approved ordination back in 1865, but yet in the decades that followed, we had all these wars with the Mormons, you know, debate, public debates, often be published in the Herald, all of which we won as published in the Herald.
of course.
yeah. And
in the Desert News, the Mormons won.
yeah. And we had Elbert A. Smith writing some book on the Smith family member who had high positions in the church. Elbert A. Smith writes a little book on fundamental differences between the two churches. And then up as late as 1960, we had 2 more books. All of them are kind of small books, but comparing the two churches. And then I'm wondering, and then I read all these articles in the Herald, why is it we never made an issue until the Civil Rights Movement in about 1958 or 1960s when we first kind of mentioned it in the Herald? Why didn't we make that an issue along with, you know, polygamy and plurality of gods and secret temple rituals and all that? Well, it's because our oldest members had about the same general views on race, and they were only becoming more acceptable until about the 50s and 60s. So, again, we really evolved with thinking of white Americans. Now, not that we weren't a little bit in the forefront, because many white Americans are still very bigoted, but at least we began to recognize that there's terrible racism here, and it's a terrible anti-Christian situation, and so we need to move forward on it. And so that's what kind of the tenor of a lot of these articles.
Right, so you have the precedents of the New Testament, Jesus reaching out to the marginalized.
Yeah.
It's more of a scriptural precedent than anything that you could find in other parts.
I think that'd be true.
Especially if you're going to be an advocate and follower of Christ.
I suspect you went back and read those 50 articles or so during that period. A lot of them would be citing New Testament especially Gospels, because the New Testament, the 4 Gospels being directed to Jesus. Paul is more theologizing, you know, to make it which helped make it Christianity universal church ultimately, but yeah, the scripture played a big role I don't think of much in the Doctrine and Covenants beyond the one we've quoted in I think section 4. There might be others, but they're not biggies that have been quoted a lot. Now, the revelations by Grant and Steve, 161 to 64, I guess Steve's got 65 now.
Yeah.
You know, they are much different kind of revelations, and I'm sure,
yes.
Well, I know there's statements in there that you could easily say, thus, you know, we've got to be totally non-racial, and, I mean, non-discriminatory on all these areas. So the non-Smith prophets have written a lot better revelations than the Smith boys have, would be my assessment.
There's definitely a different structure and feel to them. It's less, thus saith the Lord.
Yeah.
It's just more a persuasive call to people to move into different things.
Yeah, it's just more like I feel impressed that this is what I should be suggesting to the church as having divine inspiration, but not God's words. you clearly know they're talking about my words or expressing what I think is something we should be aware of, or direction we should go, or whatever.
So, under Steve Easy up and through just the 80s on till today, I would say that we could always be doing a better job, but there are quite a few members of African lineage. So we have quite a few members over in Africa, mm-hmm. for one.
Mm-hmm.
And then would you say in North America and in other places there's members? That,
well, in the U.S., we got an important congregation in Detroit, which Highland Park, I think, is the one. That's predominantly, it's integrated, but it's predominantly heavily black today. Chicago, I know, has a pretty good integrated congregation. And there are others, Battle Creek's still going, as far as I know. But in most congregations, it's probably just a case of, a few African-American members in the area, and they come to our church and fully accept it and generally don't get the kind of bad vibes that used to be pretty common earlier days, like Bishop Johnson talked about,
Yeah.
We've kind of gone into the mainstream of liberal Protestantism in the sense that we're pretty much with liberal Protestantism and Jews even more, rejecting the old racism, and treating people equal.
Yeah. But then we also have the struggle of, if we're not going to be proselyting, we're mm-hmm. kind of a reflection of people that are interested in us and come through our doors. So we've spoken about that in Salt Lake. It's just mm-hmm. like, we do a really good job of reaching out to LGBT folks and mm-hmm. a few others, but man, when I look around, we're sure a white group.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what can we do about it? Because we accept just the people that are coming through our door, and we would love for more racial inclusivity mm-hmm. if they would just.
Yeah.
So it's not on our end that we're like saying you can't stay out, but Utah's predominantly white, for example.
Mm hmm.
Just saying that I've just appreciated where Community of Christ has led. And like you said, Steve Easy has visited a lot of those countries. So he served in Africa.
Yeah.
And so to this day, I mean, you want to look at how inclusive a religion is. Look at their top leadership.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Crystal Vanna last hour was really good on that.
Yeah. So you look and we have, for example, some of the... You look at the Council of 12, we have Munda Chibwe in there, and he's from Africa.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So we have them in there, and when I went to World Conference, from what I've heard, just this transition of the days of W. Wallace Smith into Wallace B. Smith, mm-hmm. you had it, it was very, so you have men in white shirts, suits.
Ties, of course.
Just very uptight, very... And to now, where it's a lot more informal, and you have the people from Africa represented there, mm-hmm. getting up and dancing, and
Well, I love it's usually the Saturday night evening, worship service is often the case at the World Conference, where the African dramas come in, and a very important. By the way, I'd say to Lois that we've got to be there Saturday night. I mean, we'll sometimes decide to go do something else in the evening, go to a movie or something to get take a break or whatever. But we've got to be there for the drums. I just love the African drums. And, if it's all right to mention this about Utah, one year at Sunstone, 15, well, probably 20, I don't know, 15 or 20 years ago, maybe, I got here and I saw the explanation of one of the nightly sessions, and several people had been missionaries in Africa or dealt a lot with Africa one way or another, and it was billed as like we're going to hear about how the Latter-day Saint Church interacted with Africa, and you get the impression, and we modified our understandings because of the African culture we've encountered. I went there expecting to hear that. Out of four speakers, I didn't ever hear anything to suggest that the African culture in any way affected their message thereafter. You know, it's just, we went into Africa and went through the missionary message. And fortunately, you know, a decent number of people have joined. And I think that's just a miracle. I was very disappointed because I thought, if you have a significant mission into another part of the world with a quite different culture, you're going to be affected by it. Mm-hmm. And maybe they are affected by it, but those guys didn't seem to be aware of any interaction see, Chuck Neff, he's our first guy to go out into Asia, and he recognizes we got to do a whole lot of different kind of missionary effort than we do.
This was in the 50s or
60s.
60s, okay.
His first trip over there was about 60 or 61, probably 61. He'd just become an apostle in 58. Mm-hmm. But he was the ideal guy to go there. And, he didn't build a very large church in some of those countries, but he had an important effect on the church, I think.
He learned a lot from it.
Yeah. He found out these other missionaries from other denominations, they're people, they're our friends. I mean, these guys became my friends. We can work with them. We can make, we can help maybe Methodists over in this part of Korea. Well, we'll focus here, and, the Presbyterians or Baptists can focus over there. You know, that's the type of thing that's often happened in the ecumenical movement in the U.S. We try not to jump into the same area that somebody else is already there. We're all teaching Christ, and slight modifications in the teachings of each of these churches, but the basic universal message is basically the same. So we're friends. We're doing the same work. But that made Neff fairly controversial among the more conservative saints. And then he goes into Africa. I mean, he goes into India. And
In the 60s, yeah.
Yeah, and then he's getting a lot of baptisms. And at one time he's baptizing folks. And this man he knew was a polygamist walks into the water. He says, oops. He says, sorry, brother, but I'm going to have to clear this with the Church of Independence.
Yeah.
So anyway, the president and the bishopric, talk about it, and they go ahead and baptize him. With the understanding, you got to know we're a monogamous church. And yeah. if you keep your wives, that would be terrible to dump all but one. Keep your wives, but if you marry anybody else, you'll be excommunicated. I guess it's be expelled is our word for excommunication.
Right, so it's more for LDS speak versus community of Christ. When they say excommunication, what they mean is disfellowshipped. And expulsed, excommunication.
Yeah,
in LDS.
Yeah, your excommunication is our expulsion, and then we have our excommunication is basically your disfellowshipped
for the LDS, right?
For the LDS, yeah. And then, for LDS, yeah. And I was thinking you were one of those guys. And then you guys got probation. I don't know if we have anything, but we have another category, and that's silencing. Priesthood, and that's the main sanction we've used, and we used it very badly in the 1980s. If somebody in the church saw your name in the newspaper, maybe you're going to speak at one of these restoration branches, and they were just in the process of forming. A lot of them haven't even formed yet, but they're meeting together, and they advertise in the paper, and they see your name, you preach there, had some role, taught a class, sometimes they just send them a letter of silencing. That's not even talking to them. And that's one way they really, really messed up in that particular controversy in the 80s. But like, say, VC.
Really offending people by silencing their priesthood.
And, a guy might have been 35 years an elder and a very active elder in the church, a good tithe payer and everything, very supportive. But now he just can't accept the women in the priesthood thing. Or maybe the other part in there about the temple, but usually it's the women. And so you can't go that way. And instead of saying, well, okay, we understand that you feel that way now, But, you know, stick with us for a while. Maybe you'll change your mind and after you hear some women preach and stuff like that. But instead, just silencing. Well, then you get silenced, you're going to quit the church. And most of them went and joined these restoration branches.
It's pretty offensive, yeah.
Yeah, it is. And they typically lose the whole family and maybe other friends, you know. So they didn't see aware of how terrible it is, how offensive it is. And I think he had some of the top people in the church and his counselors, some of the other key apostles handled that very poorly. I tend to think he was kind of pushed into the authoritative way by his counselors, just because I know the counselors being that type of people. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, very poorly handled. Yeah. But O.C. Henson of Independence, the center stake president, handled it perfectly with Richard Price, perhaps the best. Yeah, he's the best known dissident that talked against the church. He published a lot of stuff, you know, criticizing the church. And then also, if some of the other fundamentalists or the restorationists were going in a direction he didn't like, he'd criticize them. He criticized about everybody, but he was a very good friend of mine. I mean, I just loved to go and talk to him. He was so honest, and we had some good exchanges. We'd exchange false rumors each of us heard about the other groups. But anyway, when he was silenced from the priesthood in 1985, he goes into a meeting with the stake president, and because he wasn't called to a disciplinary council, he was just called in by the president. We could talk, and we'd probably let him know he could be silenced. And so anyway, Richard just said, "Well, you know, I heard the tape." So yeah, he goes in and he says, "I'd like to tape this, and I'll give you a copy of the tape, and then I'll have a copy of the tape." And OC said, "Fine." I was just delighted that he did that, because that was so smart. I think most of our stake presidents would have said, "No, this is private." You know, but Richard's position was, "Well, this is not about a moral issue. I'm not accused of adultery or smoking pot or anything like that. I just have a different, whole different opinion. I've been proselyting, publishing that opinion." And so O.C. says, "That's fine. We'll make the tape." And I've listened to the tape, and it's just such a good meeting of the minds. And he says, they're just saying, "I'm just doing what I got to do." And O.C. says, "I understand that, Richard. That's the way you feel, you know. But, you know, I'm the stake president, and I got to do what I got to do." And Richard said, "I understand that." I had a feeling they had a parting of the ways at the end of that hour or so, where I think they parted friends. And yet many others just got a letter from the pastor or stake president silencing him. And, you know, you don't do that to a lifelong dedicated saint like Richard Price. Or in Kirtland, Ohio, 18 guys just got silenced because they published a letter in the Kirtland paper criticizing the direction the church was going. And a lot of those were longtime, you know, elders in the church, very valuable members of the church. You at least talk to them. Yeah. Now, Al, are you... You signed your name in that editorial, I mean, a letter to the Kirtland paper. Are you going and joining another church, or are you going to stay with us? You know, because we invite you to stay with us and just think through this whole thing. Mm-hmm. I just thought, so that worked really well with OC, but lousy other places. And what I thought at the time was the church leaders will recognize that they've got the advantage. It's a hierarchical church, and there's the advantage of mobility. People get ordained, a woman gets ordained one place, and then the family moves to another place. It's a more conservative congregation, but I have a good friend who just didn't even tell him that she was an elder or a priest, and they moved to another place. And after a year or two, she's well accepted in the congregation. "Oh, by the way, I did get ordained back in Nebraska." Okay, one family left from that congregation. But she announced that first, there probably would have been more. But at any rate, you got mobility, people move, and that would help congregations that have been negative in the past. And then secondly, we got scripture on our side, section 156. So we need to be patient. And they didn't do that at first. And after a few years, they realized we need to be patient, and they started letting some congregation exist as what we call enclave congregations, where they're still in the church, but they don't ordain women, and they sometimes don't use the more recent hymn book. They use the older one that's better for them, you know. So, like each hymn book has been a little more liberal the last three.
Right.
At least the last two.
Yes.
The third one before that, I don't know if it was more liberal, but it was Franklin Weddle wanted to be more professional, wanted to have more professional musicians.
That's more inclusive language, less hymns that are theologically like very atonement based or
and fewer of those old hymns
that were like war based, you know.
What a glorious thing to be in the light, you know, suggesting we're the only ones in the light. You know?
Oh, yeah.
So those kinds of hymns, you know, have greatly reduced.
Probably how they appear to everybody.
Probably none in this recent 2013 hymn, I suspect. And the Book of Mormon, that's something I need to look at a little more closely. But I'm only aware of the number of Book of Mormon citations of hymns in 1957, quite a few. In 81, fewer, about down to about three or four. And I think this one maybe has none, unless maybe be Roy Saville's, an old Judean. He has a hymn on the Book of Mormon, and he's a modern liberal leader in the church, you know.
Mm-hmm. But, I do want to return back to section 116,
mm-hmm.
because talking to Locke before this, he brought up an interesting point that I don't think was even on Joseph Smith III's radar.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this section in 116 that says, I'll just read B and C again.
Mm-hmm.
Lo, it is my will that my gospel shall be preached to all nations in every land, and that men of every tongue shall minister before me. Therefore it is expedient in me that you ordain priests unto me of every race who receive the teaching of my law, become heirs according to the promise. And then, so it's in 4a and b, be not hasty in ordaining men of the Negro race to the offices of my church, for verily I say unto you, all are not acceptable unto me as servants, nevertheless I will that all may be saved, but every man in his own order. And there are some who are chosen instruments to be ministers to their own race. So later on, we see that the negativities of separate but equal segregation. However, full circle, there came a cultural imperialism that we realized when you only have ministers from North America going to other countries.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to be your leader.
Yeah.
There's an imperialism that you're just going to bring to it.
Yeah.
And that's American superiority or whatever it may be, or a racial superiority.
Yeah.
So, looking back on this, even though the intention may have been not so great at the time, looking back, having leaders be leaders of where they're from their own country, isn't actually a positive thing. Because then at the end of the day, we can have ministers that go to their country and minister alongside of them and learn from them. But if they have their own leaders, then we have a check and balance to make sure we're not culturally imperializing over their culture, you know.
Yeah, and I don't know how far back this goes, but I know at one point, probably 20 years ago or so, I'm not sure about that, but it was a conscious decision. We need to, when we go in, then we need to start turning the leadership over to the native people, as fast as we can.
Right.
And so whenever we get to that point, then we like to just have the mission center president or I'm not sure what you have with this. I don't know if there's a title for somebody that's the head guy in Zambia or whatever, but at least have the more and more of the leadership from the countries. And
right, all the way up into influencing the world church. So, like I said, Bunda Chibwe is an apostle, and he's from Africa.
We have the Latin American guy whose name you mentioned earlier.
Carlos Mejia is from Central America somewhere.
Yeah.
And then you have Mareva from Tahiti,
et
cetera. So you have leaders that are affecting World Conference and representing on a world level the places that they're from, but then also local leadership within where they're at, too.
And I recall just a few years ago Steve making the point. I think this was when Steve came in and spent 3 hours dialoguing with the Gala organization in the church, and I was there. And I think that's when I heard him say, well, you know, we might feel like our view on gay rights is superior. It's recognizing the worth of all people and so forth. But there's things in these other cultures we're looking at that we can learn from. And so we need to be aware of that the learning goes both ways.
Yeah, it's it's not unilateral
learning. Yeah.
It's more relational, but it's a back and forth.
That's why we should bring more of the drums into American worship services. We do some places,
And I think it's great.
I love it. Yeah, the conference worship services, generally they're all really well done,
Yeah, I just think anytime we're dealing with human beings, it's going to be messy.
Yeah.
We try our best to live into full inclusivity, making sure that we are representing the values that we've put forth, but we're going to flounder along the way. But then also, like you said, what was it that you said came from the First Presidency under Wallace B. in 1984, that Revelation is, what was that phrase that you used for Revelation?
Divergent revelation? No, that's not quite the word. But anyway, the revelation is going to sometimes conflict with some previous revelations. And certainly it often conflicts with Old Testament, sometimes New Testament, sometimes earlier Doctrine and Covenants stuff. We've turned away from the Doctrine and Covenants a number of times, abandoned stakes and other things.
So. And I can't help but think the reason for that and why Revelation keeps coming and it might contradict previous Revelation is the inherent nature that God is relational to human beings and that God is pragmatic and meets us where we're at.
Yeah.
At that time.
Yeah.
In the cultural context that we're at.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like some people have said, well, why didn't you go from first grade in elementary school right to graduate school?
You are so smart.
There's steps you need to take along the way to get you there.
Yeah, like I have friends in Hungary because I took Grayson students there for the winter term of 93, and they were just in their fourth year of democracy, at least of the break. And some people were very frustrated. We're not doing very well. I said, well, the U.S., after the Constitution, it took us about a generation to really mature and recognize that opposing parties, factions, whatever you want to call them, they need to come to respect each other. And then they can get, like Henry Clay and these Daniel Webster and these guys, they might argue all day on the Senate floor, and then go out and have dinner together, and then have a play poker or something, and then go back on the Senate floor the next day and hammer it away. They were friends, and they differed. They didn't take it personally. We've lost that today, as you probably know, but it took a generation for the U.S. politicians to really come to the point where they're the loyal opposition. They're not an evil or necessary evil.
Right.
They're the opposition. They come from different backgrounds. They represent different states or districts. They're going to differ with us, so we just discuss it with them and debate with them and so forth.
Right.
So anyway, that's
versus seeing people might have different views as the enemy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, Bill, it's been a lot of fun. I'm just really thankful that you came on the podcast and talked about some of this history that the RLDS and Community of Christ went through as far as our struggles with race through the decades and how we're still to this day working on living into the message that Jesus presented 2,000 years ago.
To be truly inclusive, I guess.
To be truly inclusive.
Yeah.
Or as Paul said in Galatians 3, when you are truly baptized into Christ, that there's no longer male or female,
Jew
or Gentile. Yeah.
There's a third one, but I can't remember. Yeah, right. That's a great.
That you no longer be white or black or gay or straight. Yeah. We can add a lot
of
Jew
or Gentile,
While we may hold those particulars in our own life, that's not going to be an obstacle to being equally viewed in the eyes of God.
Ephesians 2, Christ breaks down the walls of division. Of course, he's talking about the Jew and Gentile division. And so,
All right, thanks a lot.
Well, enjoyed doing the discussion.
The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.